Morning. We welcome you all to the hearing for four petitions relating to the Code of Judicial Conduct's rules on recusal. This hearing is a bit different and yet much the same as other hearings we have on petitions for rulemaking. The one difference is that when we noticed this hearing, we put in the notice that any petitions that come in relating to the first two petitions would be put on for the same hearing rather than in series. And that's why we have today four petitions, 0816, by the League of Women Voters, 0825 by the Wisconsin Realtors, 0910 by the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and 0911 by retired Justice William Babbage. And what I plan to do is call them in that order in which they were filed. I thought of a variety of different orders. None of them seem to work, so I'm staying with the number system. Then we'll have other appearances. We usually have appearances on each proposal with the pros and the cons, but since they're interrelated, we'll just have a whole series of people who wish to present. And they can state their positions on any one or more of these proposals. I wanted to, before we begin, however, just comment about what I've listed as five the general issues that appear. There are many, many, many issues and many, many details thereof. But one is that we've got an amendment of the Code of Judicial Conduct in three petitions. And in retired Justice Babbage's petition, we have a proposal relating to the Code of Judicial Conduct 757-19. These proposals are drafted for all judges of all levels of the court. The statutes provide different contribution levels for each level of court. The proposals go from what I would label general to specific amounts. The proposals deal with direct and independent or third parties. The proposals deal with parties, lawyers, law firms, relatives, interested persons. They deal or don't deal with time duration, and an overlay in many of these is First Amendment considerations. And with that as a preliminary, I'm going to call on Virginia Bartelt, who represents the League of Women Voters, presenting in for 0816. Counsel?
Good morning. I'm Virginia Bartelt, attorney for the League of Women Voters Education Fund. We appreciate the opportunity to address the court in support of the League's petition, and we especially thank the court for setting this as a public hearing. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding and on major public policy issues, and influence public policy through education and advocacy. The League believes that the judicial branch of government must remain impartial and free from outside influence, and that the public trust in the impartiality and accountability of judges must be protected and maintained. Our justice system, and indeed our government, depends upon this. It is the role of courts to protect individual rights, guarantee equal justice, and make decisions solely on the facts and the law, free from influence of special interest in politics. There is a substantial concern about the growing influence of money in judicial elections across the nation. Some call it a crisis. The cost of running for judicial office has reached unprecedented levels. Official campaign contributions are only a small part of the recent upsurge in judicial election spending. Independent expenditures by special interest groups have exceeded spending by judicial candidates themselves, and Wisconsin is no exception from this national trend. In the 2008 Wisconsin Supreme Court election, third-party interest groups outspent official candidates 4-1. In television advertising, special interest groups were responsible for almost $9 out of $10 spent during the campaign. This upsurge has encouraged public cynicism and lack of trust. A 2008 survey of 600 Wisconsin residents showed that 78% of those polled believe that campaign contributions have a great deal or some influence on the decisions of Wisconsin judges. The case of Caperton versus Massey brought these issues into dramatic focus. In Caperton, the Supreme Court ruled that a justice could not hear a corporation's case because the board chairman and a principal officer of a corporation had spent $3 million in connection with the judicial campaign. $1,000 of that was a direct campaign contribution, and the remainder were independent expenditures. All of those contributions were legal. They were within the law. The court held that the due process clause was violated when the justice denied a recusal motion. This case involves extreme facts. As the majority opinion states, the due process clause demarks only the outer boundaries of judicial qualifications. In Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, the U.S. Supreme Court instructed that the states may adopt recusal standards more rigorous than due process requires. Justice Kennedy restated this in Caperton. Congress and the states, of course, remain free to impose more rigorous standards for judicial qualification than those we find mandated here today. Justice Kennedy continued, "These codes of conduct serve to maintain the integrity of the judiciary and the rule of law." The Supreme Court here is inviting states to adopt recusal rules to guard against harms and protect the judiciary. Recusal rules are one of the necessary tools that the court can and should employ to protect itself and preserve its integrity.
Counselor, has the League of Women Voters done any kind of legal research on the effects of individual voters' First Amendment rights if we adopt your proposal?
The League has not conducted independent research on that. I can address those matters in my presentation, and certainly some of the materials that have been submitted to the court address the issue. The First Amendment issue is an important one. Our belief is that the rule that we're proposing does not affect First Amendment rights. There is nothing in our proposed rule that prohibits that which is protected speech, and it is a right of any citizen to support the candidate of their choice. It is the judicial candidate himself or herself has free speech rights. There is nothing that prohibits that. Our position is that those free speech rights cannot trump the right of a party to litigation, to have their matter heard before a fair and impartial tribunal. And we believe that the recusal rules accommodate that. The First Amendment does not entitle anyone to have their case decided by the judge of their choice. The right to a fair and impartial tribunal must win the day.
Counsel, this deals with the code, the judicial code of conduct. If there's a violation, the judge goes through the discipline proceeding as set up. But this court has said the Code of Judicial Ethics governs the ethical conduct of judges. It has no effect on the illegal qualification or disqualification to act, and a judge may be disciplined for conduct that would not have required disqualification under 757.19.
Correct, Your Honor. The what we're asking the court to do is to amend the ethical rules to include the recusal standards therein, and then it's basically the court disciplining the judiciary itself.
But what is that good? Does that do the litigants? If it's not, if the court was correct, or maybe that the court was merely saying wouldn't have required disqualification under 757.19, but might have required disqualification under something else, like due process.
Mm-hmm. It does ensure the right of a litigant to raise the issue. It also has a significant effect that we believe upon the public confidence in the judiciary and their sense of trust that when they appear in a matter, they are not going to be subject to the undue influence of the campaign contribution. Justice Babich has taken another approach in his petition, and we find his approach to be quite thoughtful and may address the court's concern in that particular regard, rather than dealing with the codes. He's proposing a statutory change.
It doesn't necessarily have to be in the alternative. It could be conjunctive.
Correct. You could have companions right there. Our feeling is that having clear rules that all parties can rely on, that the court and the judge themselves can know that there are clear standards, will make the matters of recusal and arguments regarding impartiality much more definite and certain.
You have a $1,000 limit in yours, if I remember correctly. There's
correct.
A lot of paper floating here.
Right.
That is only 10% of what a particular individual can give under the state statute for Supreme Court justice, but it may be the total, and I have now forgotten the amount, for a circuit court judge.
Correct.
Right.
The dollar amount can be debated. There is a sense of agreement.
Let's do that.
There is a sense of agreement. I haven't heard many say that it is too small.
So you have or have not?
I have not heard that anyone saying it's too small.
Must be the contributors, not the recipients.
You should talk to more candidates.
Perhaps. The dollar amount, it is a meaningful dollar amount. We can debate whether it's the right amount, and certainly Justice Babich has suggested $10,000 and wisely suggests that it's a matter really for the court to determine. We have chosen that amount, though, because it's we've tied it to the financial disclosure requirements in the Wisconsin Code of Ethics for public officials and employees. So it's we have some basis for that dollar amount. Whether another dollar amount is appropriate, whether it's $2,000, that I think is open to debate. Our primary reason for selecting a number that people find to be low is that we can be certain with that dollar amount that the public will have confidence that the court will remain impartial and judge their matters fairly based on the facts and the law.
Ms. Bartel, let me ask you this. The state bar has suggested a study committee looking at all of the various proposals. Does the league oppose that, support that? What is your position in that regard?
Your Honor, the league is very proud to have brought this issue to the Supreme Court and is quite awed by the depth and the variety of responses that have come to the fore, and we appreciate the depth of concern that is being expressed by having the public hearing. We encourage the court, of course, to adopt the measures we're proposing, but most of all, we ask the court to consider these matters fairly openly and to act boldly in some manner to adopt recusal reform.
Does that mean that you're not opposed to a study committee?
We're not opposed to a study committee. We'd welcome the opportunity to be part of that.
Counsel, we're discussing funding here and impartiality. Who funds the League of Women Voters?
Comes from a variety of sources. Certainly the League itself is an interest group.
Do those sources include the Open Society Institute?
I'm sorry that I don't know the answer to that.
If I indicated that the League of Women Voters official website listed the Open Society Institute as one of its donors, would you have any reason to doubt that?
I would have no reason to doubt it.
Do you know what the Open Society Institute is?
Oh, this, I don't know, Your Honor, but the executive director of the league is here. That is not a member of the Wisconsin Association.
Okay. So, but the Open Society Institute is one of the donors to the league?
Responsible? Nationally.
And that's a George Soros-funded entity. Do you know that?
I don't know that.
Okay. So you wouldn't know, for instance, how much George Soros has contributed to the League of Women Voters in the last, say, 5 years?
I would not, Your Honor.
Or the last year?
No.
Could you find that out?
I imagine that I could.
Would you?
Certainly.
Okay. What kind of time frame do you think?
5 days. Within 5 days.
Okay. Thank you. Has the league taken a position on whether judges and justices in general ought to be elected or appointed?
That is certainly not a matter that is addressed in the petition. We are a supporter of the some pending matters before the Supreme Court. I'm not prepared to speak to that.
Simple question, yes or no. Does the league believe judges ought to be appointed?
The league...
Well, I think she's capable of answering the question.
Ms. Bartel.
She doesn't seem to be incapable. Go ahead.
Are you a member of the league?
I am not a member of the league. I am the attorney for
counsel. Your counsel.
Well, you say the executive director is here. If you wish to confer with her, I'm sure that wouldn't take very long.
Why don't you stand up and take the microphone, introduce yourself, tell them what the league is doing in the last, what year is their study of independence of the judiciary?
I'm Andrea Kaminsky. I'm executive director of the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin Education Fund. The league has begun to invite some speakers because our member leagues, we have 17 leagues in the state, some of them expressed an interest in looking at the judicial independence issue. Legislatively, we support the Impartial Justice Bill. And we support issue ad regulation. That's a bill. We have invited some speakers to come and talk about the question of public financing for elections and also merit selection as options that are used in other states. However, the league has not changed its position. Supporting election of judges in our state and justices.
How old is that position, do you know?
I don't know. I can look that up. I know that it is decades old.
So is the League of Women Voters committed to the ability of the people to vote for judges?
Yes, we are.
But you're reviewing that policy.
We are educating our members. We always do that. And we will not change our position without it going to our membership in a consensus process.
And so if that consensus process goes through, it's something you're taking a look at changing.
It could be. At this point, we have not even begun that process.
You have a system of identifying an issue and then taking it through your process. And then after that long process, reaching a result, but it's not on your board at the moment, answering.
That's correct.
I am, as a former league member. Yes. That was my recollection.
Yes, and it is our membership that identifies the issues that we will study. And in some cases, we study them and just so that we can speak better to them. And so that we understand them in a new context. Thank you.
Ms. Kaminsky, would you briefly explain for my benefit, but also for the benefit of other folks here today, the bills that you are supporting? You mentioned the Impartial Justice Bill, and I believe you're supporting a bill also in regard to disclosure of contributors. Could you briefly touch on that for us?
We are supporting a bill, and also there was a rule in that the GAB is poised to adopt that that would require disclosure of issue ad of independent spending for issue ad campaigns.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I?
Sorry.
May. Is the Wisconsin League affiliated with the League of Women Voters Judicial Independence Project?
Yes, that is the Judicial Independence Project is a project of our national league, and that would be the entity that, if it has accepted, I believe it has accepted funds from the Open Society Institute, by the way, and I will check into that. The state league has not, and we are separately incorporated, but we are certainly affiliated.
Well, could I ask some questions about the petition itself?
Yes.
How did you come about taking the position that's articulated in this petition?
Would you like me to answer?
Whoever.
You want to take that answer? The particulars, it arises out of some study. Certainly, it involved study of the developments following the White decision. And we certainly were influenced by the writings and reviewed them in particular. There was input from various parties on the particular proposals. The thought was, though, that dealing with one particular issue in a limited way would be a good start to opening the topic of recusal reform, and it also would be a meaningful reform that would have a very immediate impact. The matter of the $1,000 as the limit was also a matter of discussion, and pinning it to a standard that already exists in statute was the conclusion that was settled upon.
Now, this petition dates back to fairly early last year, is that right?
Right, April of 2008.
So you've had an opportunity to study your own proposal?
Study our own proposal as well as those of others, and then watch the developments in the case law. Certainly, Caperton, the Caperton decision followed.
Have you had any rethinking of your own proposal over the last year and a half?
Well, we did do a slight amendment to the petition in light of developments. So there were some slight modifications in it, and I think that there certainly has been a change in our thought about the petition from the beginning, feeling that this, as a standalone proposal, was a fair proposal. We've come to the conclusion that we stated in response to Justice Kirk's question. We do support that if the court decides to do further study, we support that. We realize these are very complex issues. They require deep thought and a coordinated response. There are many different approaches that can be taken. If the league's petition is one of those aspects, that's wonderful. If the league has merely served to open the discussion, that also is wonderful. The most important conclusion for us would be that the court adopts some significant, meaningful recusal rules and reform related to judicial campaign contributions and independent expenditures.
Would it be fair to say that you gave a lot of thought to this petition?
Yes.
Okay. In the commentary that starts the petition, the league asks the court to adopt rules for recusal when a party in an action or the lawyers in an action has previously made a campaign contribution to or spent money on a media campaign relating to a judicial election for a judge who is presiding in the case.
Or the law firm.
Well, I'm just reading here. Where does it refer to attorneys in this petition?
The amended petition corrects that error. The discussion at the time of the filing of the petition exceeded the text of the petition itself, and so the amended petition brings up and includes the lawyer in the petition.
So it's not simply a party anymore, it's the attorneys itself.
Correct.
The amended petition is in tab one of our materials.
Has there been a change to the language in proposed 6004G2 or 3?
One other change was with regard to the period of time for the contribution, limiting it to 2 years.
So there's a 2-year time limit?
Starting when?
Now, is the definition of mass electronic communication changed?
No.
All right. And mass electronic communication means the transmission of 50 or more substantially identical materials by means of electronic mail or facsimile transmission?
Correct.
That's right. Does that include email?
It would.
So let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose Justice Bradley were running, and she were invited to participate in a reception at Foley and Lardner, which is a fairly large law firm, a little bigger than your law firm. And notice of that was put out to all the attorneys and the staff at Foley and Lardner. Isn't that an electronic communication?
It doesn't cost anywhere. It doesn't cost anywhere near $1,000.
Doesn't say anything like that. I don't see the $1,000 in sub two,
no.
Or three.
It could potentially fall within. It would not be the intention to have an internal email be the subject of these rules.
But you thought so carefully about this petition and its impact. But you didn't think of that? Well, let me ask this. Would a newspaper be covered by this petition? Does a newspaper fit into the definition of entity or organization or anything like that?
If a newspaper were a party to a proceeding?
Well, newspapers are parties to proceedings all the time here.
There's no particular reason why it would not, if a newspaper is a party, apply.
So that, okay, let's say a newspaper endorses Justice Ziegler. Now, that's extremely valuable to have such an endorsement. And that newspaper then is involved in an open record suit. Does that mean that Justice Ziegler could not sit in that case?
Justice, our definitions define... they define mass distribution and mass electronic communication. Earlier, it does refer to spending money on those, and therefore would fall under the $1,000 amount.
You don't think, for example, that it costs $1,000 to publish the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel?
It could well be that a newspaper could fall within the rules, and there's no particular reason why they should be exempt, depending on the particular circumstance.
Well, perhaps there's free speech might be a consideration.
And our position is that all parties are free to articulate their thoughts about a particular candidate. They're free to support their candidate, but it doesn't mean that particular justice, that they're entitled to have that particular justice decide their case.
Okay,
the non-moving party ought be entitled to a fair and impartial tribunal.
Now, I want to ask one last question, or maybe not one last question. If the people in this room and the people of Wisconsin went to the website of the Wisconsin League of Women Voters, are you representing to the court that there would not be anything on that website that indicates a preference for appointing judges and justices, or at least justices? There's nothing on that website?
There is nothing on that website to that effect.
Counselor, along the lines of what Justice Prosser was asking you, as I reviewed your petition, one thing that I was a bit, well, there are several things that concern me because it's a really complicated issue. The more you get into it, in fact, it doesn't get easier, it gets harder. But one thing I was concerned about, just say a justice was running for the court and a union endorsed that justice. Now, it's typical that the unions communicate who their choice is to their members. They do it in written materials that they sent out by mail. They do it in email in some circumstances. They have things on their website. Would all of that count in your $1,000 limit? And if it does, I can assure you no union could ever participate in a case with that justice during your timeline, because all of those things are going to go way over $1,000.
If the union was a party, that would...
So they couldn't then tell their member which person on the of the two or three that were running for the court they thought would make the best justice.
They can tell their members. They can provide whatever information they choose to their members. There is nothing in the rule that prohibits that.
No, but then they could not have that justice participate, and the only reason they tell their members that was a good justice is if they thought that person was going to be fair and impartial and understood issues that probably relate to unions in perhaps a little different way than the issues relate to others. But those all would count under your rule. Okay, fine, thank you.
You know, maybe one of the imports of these questions is that justices are getting more than just money, but are getting at endorsements and communication to members with or without public endorsements, et cetera. And that these petitions deal only with contributions. I'm trying to think whether they deal with something else. And that it's part of maybe a bigger picture, regardless of whether your particular petition raises these issues about money.
Right. Our petition is designed to deal with contributions, not merely words expressed to others, but rather contributions that influence campaigns.
Well, but counsel, aren't there a lot of different ways to contribute to a campaign? And sometimes the most valuable contribution is manpower, is sending out the email, is finding a way to communicate with a large group of people for a small cost, is sending out postcards. It's who knows what it is. Why isn't a dollar value attached to that? Why isn't that equally as important? Why wouldn't that matter to the litigant who's sitting in court wondering if they're getting a fair shake? Why isn't that just as important?
Those kind of non-monetary contributions can indeed be significant, and of course anyone running a campaign would appreciate the significance of them. Our rule is designed simply to deal with the monetary contributions. However, it would be quite difficult to quantify value of other contributions, and the rule...
All these are difficult issues,
yes.
But just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's not worthy of consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're going to start eating the elephant, you do it one bite at a time, right? But here we are trying to deal with this big issue, but you're either going to deal with it or you aren't. You can't just deal with one part of it, just single out one part of it. I mean, really, we're talking about fairness, and we're talking about people having the perception of fairness and being treated fairly in court, which is very critically, fundamentally important. So, too, is it important that justices sit on cases, judges sit on cases, we decide cases fairly and impartially for people. People have the right to come to court and know that they're going to have, hopefully, seven people sitting. We don't have, like in Caperton, a situation where there could be other people inserted in that justice's place. People deserve to have their matters heard. And one of the criticisms in your petition or of your petition is that, I mean, let's just say hypothetically, we have a landslide fundraising on one side and almost no funds that are raised on the other side. A lawyer might, or a law firm might, say, gee, this is a foregone conclusion. Candidate A is going to win. I don't want them on my case. I'm going to give them $1,000. You're judge shopping. That's one of the fundamental tenets behind not allowing people to kind of fine-tune the court or try to undo elections. And that's one of the criticisms of your petition. So those are some of the things that trouble me. I mean, if we really do want to address the issues, we ought to address the issues and not just tackle the ones that are easy to place a dollar figure on. So help me out with that.
The primary issue that the League was trying to address in its petition is the erosion that's caused to public trust and confidence and confidence in the integrity of the courts because of the high dollar amounts that are involved in elections. No one would criticize active participation by all citizens in their local elections and elections at any level. So active participation by being out there, you know, in your person and stuffing envelopes, we don't see that as a pernicious evil. I'm not aware that people consider that to be an ill that needs to be addressed. For that reason, our petition does not address it. On the matter of...
we've got 12 people that have to talk. So we'd appreciate if you could wind up. You have a written presentation and a petition. And if you want to do other writings, you may do so. But if you would try and conclude, I'd appreciate that.
My only final comment that I haven't been able to make already is that the petitions of the Wisconsin Realtors Association and the Manufacturers and Commerce seem to suggest that there can be no recusal reform in light of the First Amendment. And I think that conclusion is really contrary to the Supreme Court's direction in both White and Caperton. So again, we thank you for this opportunity to present to the court, and we look forward to the continued discussion and thorough review of these matters. Thank
you. Counsel, if you'd like to submit any additional answers to my questions, since you didn't have the chance to really address them, feel free to do so.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bartelt, and Executive Director, on behalf of the court, I want to thank you for bringing forth this petition. As you said, it started a cascade of, maybe four isn't a cascade, but close, of petitions that have come to the court. The court has decided to appoint a commission to study the code generally. The court was faced with the issue of whether to put on these petitions for its hearing and its decision, or to submit it to a study committee, and at least in last spring, the court decided it would benefit from hearing these petitions openly and publicly itself. What you have found out is that what seems simple and direct has to then be dealt with in indirect manners because it's easy to run around any provision, and it involves more than contributions. So we appreciate the League and we appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next presenter is Hannah Renfro, counsel for the Wisconsin Realtors Association in 08-25. Ms. Renfro.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Hannah Renfro. I'm with Godfrey & Kahn, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Wisconsin Realtors Association. The realtors are asking this court for a simple clarification on an issue that is extremely significant and extremely urgent. The realtors are asking this court to amend the code to provide clarity, to make clear that a campaign contribution or an endorsement does not, in and of itself, require a judge to recuse over a matter. Now, this issue is a simple clarification because what the realtors are asking is for the court to make express in the code what is already implicit in the rules. The rules already require a judge to recuse if the judge cannot preside over a matter impartially or with the appearance of impartiality. It is significant and urgent because the rights that we are talking about here today are the First Amendment rights that belong to all the people of this state and groups to support judicial candidates. Now, there is no question that campaign contributions are a form of protected speech. And contrary to the league's position, that a per se rule mandating recusal is an infringement on that right. And the lack of clarity that currently surrounds the rules and the practice on judicial recusal has had a chilling effect on speech. Now, this matter is urgent because the spring elections are mere months away, not years. And it is urgent because we must provide notice to all the participants in judicial elections on the rules regarding judicial recusal. And the participants in judicial elections include judges and the judicial candidates, the potential and the actual supporters of candidates, and the people and the groups of this state who come before the courts on a daily basis.
But what does the rule tell me as a candidate? It says be reasonable. Well, I agree that that's a good rule, but there's something about a dollar amount that's specific, clear, although we found out it is not so specific and not so clear because we don't know what is involved in the calculation. But there's something that, if you want to help me when I'm running, you know, if you give me a flat, rigid rule, it might not help me, but it helps me in terms of a recusal.
That flat, rigid rule, Chief Justice, is provided in Chapter 11 of the Wisconsin statutes.
That would say $10,000 in a Supreme Court race and lesser amounts in other races.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
That's my rule.
Yes.
So if I get $10,000, I can sit?
Unless there's some other reason to require your recusal. Yes, Your Honor.
Let me, if I may, give you a hypothetical. Let's say there is a group of 20 people that all work for the same company. And each of those 20 people give $10,000 in a Supreme Court race. And that company is a party to a case before the Supreme Court. What's the realtor's position?
The realtor's position is that those individuals have a First Amendment right to make a lawful campaign contribution to support that judge's or that justice's candidacy, mm-hmm. and that unless there's another reason to recuse, then the judge or the justice should sit before on the case.
That's the difficulty of our job here today, is because there's so many balancing interests. First Amendment, as someone recently said in a program I was participating in, you know, is the bedrock of our country, right?
Right.
But if you're John Smith, who is also a party to that same action, and you are suing this company, and if you quit, you know, make yourself feel like you're John Smith, do you think you're going to feel like you're going to get a fair shake?
I don't think the answer, Your Honor, to improving the public's perception of the judiciary is to require recusal. Because any sort of mandatory rule that requires a judge to recuse from presiding over a case based on a lawful campaign contribution must rely on the assumption that that judge is necessarily and inherently partial based on a campaign contribution. Is it troubling that so many members of the public have lost or have their confidence in the judiciary has waned. Absolutely. But the answer is not to mandate recusal. The answer could be that we spend resources on educating the public and that we protect the First Amendment rights of individuals and groups to participate in judicial elections.
If I asked that same question, if I went out right now around the state capitol, or I went out around Main Street in virtually any community in this state and said, if you were John Smith, do you think you'd get a fair shake? Do you think you'd want that judge on the case? What do you think the response would be?
Frankly, I think that a lot of responses would be that perhaps they wouldn't get a fair shake. But that does not mean that this court can impose in the Code of Judicial Conduct an infringement on the First Amendment right of individuals and groups to make campaign contributions.
Since we're talking about hypothetical questions posed to average citizens, what do you think the response on Main Street would be if you ask someone if they need to be protected by the government, if the government ought to be telling them what to do with the citizens, what they ought to be doing with their own money, and who they ought to support, and in what amount they ought to support? And what do you think their responses on Main Street would be to that?
I think their response would be, Your Honor, that the people of the state do not want the government telling them how to spend their money.
In fact, is there an argument, and if I'd had the chance to ask the representatives from the League of Women Voters this, I would have asked, that as an entity which proclaims to have as a mission the education of the electorate, does it seem to you and the people you represent that maybe this whole idea, this assumption that serves as the bedrock for the petition which started all of this, seems to be that the government ought to be doing something as opposed to talking with the individual citizens, much along the lines of what you have to do during a campaign? A campaign is spent talking with citizens, trying to find voters, trying to meet with as many voters as you can to convince them that your point of view is in line with their own. It seems to me your response to the previous justice's question serves as a fundamental difference in perspective about who ought to be doing what about these perceptions we keep hearing about. The League of Women Voters seems to think that it's the government that ought to be doing something. Others seem to think that it's if the people have a problem with it, if the people think in that hypothetical that was posed to you that they're not going to get a fair shake, that they have a remedy for that. And it occurs on a periodic basis set by the statutes. We call it an election. Please respond to that.
I would agree with Your Honor that if the people of this state do not like the way that a judge has made decisions or do on recusal or any other matter, then the people of this state have a right to not elect that judge in the next election.
Ms. Renfro, let me ask you, because this is something that troubles me. We have, when we look at the code and we look at the statute, we have both a subjective standard and an objective standard. Do you have any comment on how those standards can be balanced? For instance, the question asked by Justice Bradley certainly would seem to go to the objective standard. As I listen to Justice Gableman, I'm hearing much more a subjective standard. They're both there. How do we balance that?
A couple of responses. First is that the United States Supreme Court's decision in Caperton certainly calls into question whether a subjective standard can be applied. Under our rule petition, whether it's a subjective standard or an objective standard or a mix of the two, a campaign contribution still should not, a lawful campaign contribution in and of itself does not mandate recusal. So our position on that matter is that on the issue of the standard is just that.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked the League of Women Voters representatives. Does the Board of Realtors, the Realtors Association, have any objection to the proposal by the State Bar that there be a study in regard to all of these proposals and other proposals perhaps as well?
It is the Realtors' position that this matter needs to be addressed promptly. As I indicated, the spring elections, they're not years and years away, they're months away. And the lack of clarity that currently surrounds the practice of recusal and in the rules of recusal now has had a chilling effect on a First Amendment right. And for that reason, this matter needs to be dealt with urgently. And we fear that if this would go before a study commission, that it'll be years. It'll certainly be past the upcoming spring elections before there's resolution on this matter. And in addition, there is a clear proposal before the court in the Realtors' rule petition.
So I take that as your answer being that the Realtors do not support a study. Is that correct? Just so it's clear.
Well, the Realtors do not oppose studying this issue.
But just so we do it quickly.
If that study can be done today, then the Realtors
can be done. Do you think that we could have a week or two?
I think weeks. I don't know. I have to talk to the board about that. But I also think it's important to note that this matter has been briefed extensively. This matter didn't come before the court in the last week. This matter has been before the court for over a year now.
And the issues are even older than that.
Yes, they are. They did not.
I have several questions. One, your petition is that a judge is not required to recuse herself solely on receipt of a lawful campaign. There are a lot of criteria that are found in other states that are found in the materials here, like the size, the timing, the percent of the total. Under Justice Bradley's example, if 20 people gave $10,000 each, all working for the same company, was a party, it's $200,000. And suppose the total campaign raised only $300,000. Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference?
No, if they're lawful contributions, then no.
You don't want any other criteria, but you say it has to be solely. And solely would not. What else is there other than the amount?
Well, there could be any number of other factors. The judge or the justice, we're certainly not, the judge or the justice could feel that if they know a party.
That'll fall under another rule, whether they gave a dollar or not.
Exactly.
Okay, so you have to fall under another rule, not just the contribution.
Well, the court
rule
takes it, and consistent with the United States Supreme Court's decision in Caperton, made clear that what must be considered by the court in analyzing whether recusal is required, it is a fact-intensive, circumstance-specific inquiry. Now, if the court feels that there are other circumstances other than the lawful amount, then, of course, if a court feels that a judge cannot be impartial, then the judge should recuse.
Okay. You don't cover independent contributions, is that right? Or have I not read you correctly?
No, our rule petition does not cover independent.
It doesn't cover independent. Okay. Third, what's the matter with just saying that any justice, judge, we could just use judge and define it, shall disqualify himself or herself in any proceeding in which his or her impartiality might reasonably be questioned? That language comes from U.S. Code Section 455, which is kind of like our 757-19. It also appears in a variety of state codes and state statutes.
on recusal. So instead of going into contributions, and then a lot of them just put as a comment or as an example, contributions. Do you know what I'm trying to say? That you have a general standard of reasonableness. That standard then, one example of it is contributions. And 455 of the United States Code has been interpreted as standards higher than due process. That is, you don't need the, as Caperton says, the extreme circumstances under 455. And my, you can answer that with the other thing is, you can talk all you like, you can give all the money you want, but the First Amendment does not entitle you to a particular judge. I mean, that's the answer that's given in all the other materials that's been filed with us, and that the Constitution does guarantee, I shouldn't say guarantee, does provide that you have an impartial judge, not only actual, but more importantly, appearance of impartiality under the 14th Amendment. A lot of questions. What about reasonableness?
Yes.
Go ahead.
If I forget to answer any of those questions, for sure let me know. With respect to the reasonableness issue, the reasonableness standard in Section 455 of the U.S. Code is similar to the provision that we currently have in place in the state. And what we have seen, however, is that without the lack of clarity that a campaign contribution does not in and of itself require recusal, without that clarity, there's been a chilling effect on speech, as I said before. And there is inconsistent practices that are being imposed at this point in time. So although that language, so we already have basically that language here, there needs to be.
What about putting it in 757.19? We don't have that language in 757.19.
With respect to the reasonableness, I don't think, well, Chief Justice, I don't think that will cure the problems that have been raised and the reasons why we brought this rule petition to begin with.
Because you want something specific about contributions. You don't object to a reasonableness standard.
No, Your Honor.
You just want, in addition to a reasonableness standard, as an example of reasonableness being contributions solely.
Yes. And with respect to the entitlement to a particular judge, the League is correct. There is no right to have a particular judge preside over a particular matter. But there are at least three other rights and interests that are at stake. Now, a party may not be entitled to a judge, but contributors are certainly not entitled to not be treated differently than any other litigant. Contributors have a First Amendment right to make those lawful campaign contributions, and to require recusal penalizes the exercise of that form of political expression. So there's the First Amendment rights that are at issue.
Counsel, I'm sorry, no, please finish your question.
No.
I just remember I was a young justice. I was in the conference room when I was pushing for a particular point of view, and then Justice Babich said to me, there is no absolute right. And that's one of the, he didn't say it quite that harshly. I'm just interpreting it. And that rings in my ear now. First, you're arguing as though the First Amendment is the only right, and it's above all rights. That's what's one of the things that makes our job so difficult and so interesting, a balancing of rights. I mean, you're not arguing the First Amendment has to always trump everything, are you?
No, Your Honor, but the balance that's at issue here, it's not a matter of balancing one party's due process rights to an impartial court. That, of course, exists, to another party's First Amendment right.
because that presupposes that a party's right to an impartial court is threatened by the other party making a lawful campaign contribution.
Oh, there we go again.
Not the balancing that's at issue here.
There we go again, where there are two fundamental differences of opinion. It seems to me a reasonable argument can be made in regard to the petition that started all of this, that starts with a presumption that judges are going to be tainted for $1,000, and they're going to be willing to throw a case for $1,000. Whereas, I don't know that I've heard anyone mention yet this morning the possibility that people contribute to certain candidates and judicial candidates because they want a fair judge or a fair justice, and that is their stake. Is that a possible way of viewing this?
Absolutely, and that was it's a perfect segue, because that is the other interest that is at stake here, is that the people of the state of Wisconsin are entitled to have the judges who they elect as the most qualified candidate to preside over the cases that come before that court, whether that is at the circuit court, the court of appeals, or the Supreme Court level.
How do you then deal with Caperton? That was a contribution case, directly or indirectly, and the court said the judge can't sit, right? So there comes a point where your freedom to speak through money is limited by due process. Have I misinterpreted all this?
Well, Chief Justice, the Caperton did not just involve a contribution. At issue in Caperton was a $1,000 lawful campaign contribution and then almost $3 million in independent spending. Oh. In addition to an array of other facts regarding the timing, regarding the election itself, that compelled the court to find that due process required recusal in that case. And the court made clear that the facts in that case were, in the court's language, extreme and extraordinary.
Well, then when I asked you about what solely, and I said to you the percent of the contribution into the total, the timing, et cetera, we're not willing to add those criteria for the purposes of the judge making a decision. I gave you the example of a $200,000 contribution of these people from one company out of $300,000. That's two-thirds.
Our rule does not, the rule petition proposed by the realtors does not, of course, require a judge to preside over any matter. No rule can do that. The judge can take into consideration the factors that are important to him or her.
And you recognize that these are important under Caperton and other cases.
Yes, but I do think it's
solely the contribution, but other factors.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The 10 grand by A might not knock you out, but the fact that everybody in that company gave 10 grand and you now have $1.5 million out of $1.6 million might knock you out.
And under the realtor's rule petition, a judge, of course, can still take those factors into account. But I do think that it's important to remember that in Caperton, that case, had it just been a $1,000 campaign contribution that was at issue, I don't think the Supreme Court would have been hearing that.
Was Caperton a unanimous decision?
No, it wasn't.
What was the vote?
It was a 5-4 vote, I believe.
And were the five members of the majority able to articulate a rule that would carry forward outside of the particular facts of Caperton versus Massey Coal Company?
No, they were not. In fact, that was emphasized by the dissent.
They stated no rule at all?
Well, they stated a rule. Yes, they absolutely
stated a rule you might not think is effective, that the dissent didn't think it's effective, but that's the purpose of a dissent, to knock it around, right?
Yes.
So they did state a rule, right?
Yes.
And what was the rule?
The rule in that case was that due process requires a judge to recuse where the where the judge's impartiality is in question. And in that case, the court took, the rule there is that a court must take into account all of the facts and the circumstances surrounding, whether it's spending or a contribution or whatever other facts are present that are challenging that judge's ability to be impartial.
An objective, reasonable person standard.
Yes.
Not only actual bias, but the appearance of bias.
Yes.
Didn't the author of the majority opinion call Caperton a case of extreme facts?
Yes.
Well, since we're talking about it so much, and we're talking about that case, and it's some are seem to indicate that it has applicability to what we're talking about here, what were the facts of Caperton?
The facts of Caperton were, as I mentioned, a $1,000 lawful campaign contribution, a $2.5 million that was donated to a Section 527 organization, more than $500,000 that was spent on independent expenditures, such as television ads. There was the facts also involved the timing of the contribution relative to
and
the
that election. Was all contributed by one contributor?
Yes, who was the CEO of the company who was a party to
okay, so we're looking at a fact scenario where one contributor spent $3 million out of a total of how much was spent in the race.
I don't have that exact figure right in front of me, but it was, I believe, that was more than what was spent actually by the campaign itself.
Both campaigns combined? How did it compare to the individual contributions of the candidates?
Yeah, it was actually the, it was the three times the amount that was spent by the Justice's own campaign committee. The contribution.
And more than both campaigns combined.
Yes, Your Honor.
And neither candidate significantly contributed to their campaign, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Renfro, your petition is one of four before the court?
I'm sorry, what?
The realtor's petition is one of four petitions before the court,
yes.
If I'm not mistaken. Do you like anything you see in other petitions?
Well, we have indicated our support for the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce's rule petition on independent spending. And we don't disagree that, I would just leave it at that.
Well, are there any other questions? Do you have a fast sum up, please?
I can absolutely do a fast sum up. I just want to emphasize that the realtors urge this court to take action, to choose to take action, and to take action promptly. The code, it must be amended in order to provide clarity in the rules and the practice regarding judicial recusal. And to provide that notice, the realtors have offered a provision or a rule petition to amend the rules that is clear and that would provide that necessary clarity. And I do want to make a point about the league's proposed, its proposed amendments. It sets an arbitrary standard that not only restricts the rights of supporters of judicial candidates and people to engage in the political process, but it will come with an enormous administrative burden, along with a host of other costs to the judiciary. And there it's not in clear at all that it will improve the public's perception and protect the confidence of the public in the judiciary. Now we ask, as a result, that the court adopt our rule petition.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We are going to hear from Michael Wittenweiler, who is going to present the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce proposal.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mike Wittenweiler. I'm also of Godfrey and Kahn, and I'm here this morning on behalf of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Along with about a dozen other organizations, Wisconsin Manufacturers that have signed on in support of our petition, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is here today to urge the court to adopt a new provision to the Judicial Code of Conduct. The provision that we're suggesting that the court adopt would make it clear that a judge shall not be required to recuse himself or herself solely because of a party to the proceeding either sponsoring an independent communication or contributing, donating to another organization that then in turn sponsors an independent communication. When I say independent communication, I'm including with that both independent expenditures and issue advocacy communications. For the benefit of the court, the independent expenditure would be a communication sponsored by a political action committee regulated under state campaign finance law. Issue advocacy would be a grassroots lobbying communication, something that stops short of telling voters who to vote for or against, but addresses still a public policy concern. With both of these communications, with neither of them can be coordinated in any way with a candidate or a candidate's campaign. These communications are done solely separate and distinct from the candidate's campaign. We have a state standard in Wisconsin on coordination that's been adopted by our Government Accountability Board that makes sure that these communications occur in a way that there is no candidate involvement. It's totally separate. There's no control. There's no input. It's going to occur irregardless of what a candidate's feeling may or may not be toward the communication. The candidate can't stop it. They can't start it, again, which is the key hallmark to looking at these independent communications. They're not contributions to a candidate that a candidate can reject. This is, again, it's something that's going to go on regardless of what else is going on. Both of these forms of independent communications are protected political speech, and they're subject to minimal regulation. And I think what's most important for the court today is that both of these forms of independent communication aren't subject to any spending limits, much like none of your campaigns are subject to a spending limit. If you're a really good fundraiser as a candidate, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you as a candidate can spend as much as you want. You just have to take the contribution in regulated chunks. When it comes to independent communications, the same principle applies. The spending that's going to occur because it's independent of the candidate can occur in an unlimited amount. The U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly said that these independent communications cannot be subject to a spending limit.
Well, you just mentioned if you're a really good fundraiser, what about a very wealthy individual?
The same principle would apply.
That would be no limit.
Correct.
Other than the wealthy individual's pocketbook and desire to fund the campaign.
Correct. The U.S. Supreme Court, beginning in the Buckley decision and in decisions subsequent to that, has said that while there may be contribution limits that would apply to other individuals who are going to contribute to your campaign, the candidate's ability to self-finance their election is not limited. The same principle applies that if you have a wealthy individual, you know, we often think of independent expenditures as those communications that are sponsored by political action committees. Any one of us has the ability to sponsor an independent communication by merely going down to whoever the clerk is for that election and filling out some paperwork and saying, I'm going to take out an ad as myself if I have the ability. I don't have to do it through a political action committee.
Can you clarify a couple of things for me? I'm just curious. The brief talks about WMC.
Correct.
But WMC puts out ads? Or does it have a separate entity and separate board?
As pointed out in the brief, there are, as with many, you know, if you look at the different organizations that signed in support, if you look at membership organizations, they often have a brand, and then they have a different tax-exempt organizations that fall under that brand. In the case of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, you have the 501c6 Trade Association, which exists. It has an affiliated organization called Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Issues Mobilization Council, which is a 501c4 advocacy group. It's affiliated in the sense of the tax code and connected to WMC, but the communications actually occur through it. For its independent expenditures, those occur through its political action committee, which is also another separate account. The tax code is what dictates you to kind of set up these regimes.
So is the board the same between WMC and its Issues Mobilization Council?
No, there are two separate boards of directors for that.
Who's on the board of directors for the Issues Mobilization Council?
I am not sure who is on the current board. In the past, I believe it's the president of WMC, one of the executive vice presidents, and the secretary. To be honest, Justice Ziegler, I haven't looked at their annual report filing with the Financial Institutions Department in a while, but if I recall from several years ago, those were the three board members.
Okay.
Well, would the Issues Mobilization Council take a position that on the issue ads that didn't fit with the, what the WMC board's positions are?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Would the Issues Mobilization Council or the Action Committee or Commission take positions in their issue ads that were not contrary to what the WMC,
no.
they would be consistent
correct.
With what the WMC as a board or as an organization
consistent with corporate governance of most trade associations, labor organizations. When you have these affiliated entities, generally somewhere in the bylaws it's going to spell out that there's a board of director that oversees other boards, but for the purpose of functionality and day-to-day operation, you know, you don't want to always be going back to that board of directors, and every organization varies.
So they're doing what the public, what the policy of the entity is.
Correct.
And you can find out the names of the board members from your website.
Correct. They are listed on the website.
But there are different board members for the
Correct.
Different entities.
They are different.
And ultimately, the board members of the one entity would make the decisions for ads, for example.
Yes, but as the Chief Justice points out, there's some accountability there that it's more about, you know, the day-to-day operation of it.
What do you think we do with entities that label themselves something and participate meaningfully and spend a lot of money in Supreme Court races, but you can't figure out who funds them? How do we deal with that? At least with yours, we have an idea of who's involved, and so does the public.
Well,
what do you do with the other ones?
You know, under current campaign finance law, under the current tax code, there are varying levels of disclosure depending about how you're structured. You know, if you look at in the Caperton case, the Section 527 organization that Mr. Blankenship funded, because of the way they're structured in the tax code, those reports are available online. Anyone can go to the IRS website and find out who those donors are. Had he contributed to a 501c4 organization, the donors are disclosed in the tax forms that are provided to the IRS, but they are not made public. There's a public policy decision because of the Right Association and concerned under the First Amendment of, you know, who's giving to different organizations, that we have a public policy in place that says those individuals are not disclosed.
I'm just thinking it from the justice's perspective. How would you find out? You have some group out there that's doing ads. You're trying to figure out who these people are, so you know that you have to recuse yourself from their case, but you can't find out because the names are hidden from the public. So,
well, I don't want to hold WMC IMCF as a model of reform, but quite frankly, they take away the concerns that I think the League of Women Voters and others have, because you don't have to worry about those issues. If you don't know who's contributing to them, you aren't presented necessarily with the concern of whether or not a particular party before the court, you know, because you're not aware of it. There was a proposal written years ago by a law school professor who suggested that in judicial races, what we really need to do is have everyone give to a black box, and the black box then turns out the money so that the judges are never made aware of who makes those contributions. Because it removes that issue and that concern that somehow you establish partiality based on who the identity of a donor is. One way to remove that appearance of partiality would be to tell people to give to groups like WMC IMC, who do not disclose the name of their donors.
Counselor, I enjoyed reading your brief, and I am most interested in the intersection of the petitions that are pending and the First Amendment rights. And I would like to know if you can discuss a little bit more for me how you think your addition to Supreme Court Rule 60.04 enhances First Amendment rights, but yet does not step upon each individual person's right to due process as they come before the court.
And Justice Rogacek, I think to myself personally, and as comes through in that brief, that's what's key here. It is that balancing of the First Amendment right and the due process concerns expressed in Caperton. What the rule we have put forward to the court is, what it would do to the Judicial Code of Conduct is it would say, by itself, an independent communication is not a reason for recusal. The word solely is in there for a very important reason, because there may still be other concerns, other factors that come up, like in the Caperton situation, where there are extreme facts, extreme circumstances that must be taken into account by either the judge subjectively or whatever the body is that's looking at it objectively. And I will admit, I'm confused myself exactly what your standard is in front of the court today.
because of, you know, with the Caperton decision, I think it does call into question the American TV decision and whether or not you need to have a form of objective review to make recusal decisions.
Well,
but the point, excuse me, Chief Justice.
Go ahead, Mike.
To answer your question is in that review, what you would have with the adoption of the rule that we've asked the court to look at is there would be guidance to the judges out there that the independent communication on its own does not rise to the level that recusal is warranted. It may be a factor. It may be one item that either the judge subjectively or the body that's overseeing it objectively looks at, but it's not the sole reason. And again, we feel that clarity is needed. When you look at the decision that you reached as a body in the Donahue case, I think it calls out the need for clarity. It calls out the need for direction on these matters, and that's what we're asking the court and why we would like them to adopt this rule. But it does balance that First Amendment and the due process concerns.
You have an issue of the code, judicial conduct, having an objective standard.
Correct.
A code does not necessarily mean disqualification in a case. You could have discipline of the judge under the code, but he or she sits on the case according to the case law of the state, or it can be so interpreted. Do you agree?
I agree with you on that.
Okay.
And if there's ever an issue for a study commission to look at, that would be a great one. I don't think it's independent communications, but if there's something that a study commission could tackle, it's that discrepancy between the code of conduct and the state.
Then why aren't you proposing that 757.19 be added to have what your provision in the code is so that you have an objective standard, which now is not in 757.19? Which Justice Bamblich's proposal, which you don't like because it has a dollar amount, but that's what it does.
For the reason that I think Justice Rogenczyk is bringing up is because it's a balance, because it's a balancing between the First Amendment and the due process interest, that what we want is we want something in the judicial code to give guidance to people as to a factor that they need to be looking at. The question of whether or not it needs to be done subjectively or objectively, whether or not that code provision somehow needs to be weaved into the disqualification statute, I think is a question for another day and not something that we came before the court to address.
Yeah, but this whole thing is a recusal. But everything that is presented deals with the discipline of a judge. It does not deal with the parties. It does not deal with the parties' rights for an impartial decision maker. So why, when you talk about recusal, you're only talking about it from the judge's standpoint, not the parties.
And Your Honor, that is what we are talking about, because the way we look at, you know, the combination of Caperton with the Legal Women Voters proposal prompts us to be here today to say what judges need in Wisconsin is they need clarification. They need some clarity that the independent communication of itself is not necessarily a need for recusal. You're absolutely right. We didn't propose it to be amended to 757. We focused on Chapter 60 because when you read that preamble to the Judicial Code of Conduct, it tells you, or it kind of draws you in and says, if you're going to provide clarity to judges, if you're going to give them something to think about, this is the place to do it. And then could it come in through 757? Sure, I think it could through, I think it's G, whatever the last subjective decision by the judge for disqualification. I think a judge that looks at 757 on disqualification turns to the judicial code of conduct, and if they see the petition that we've put forward today, it's something they're going to take into consideration.
But not reviewable, other than did the judge look at it?
And again, I would agree with you that that's an inconsistency that you have between the code and the statute, and it would be a great topic for a study commission to work out how you want to deal with that.
Just fix it up by putting a reasonable standard like 455 has it or the other codes have? Having an objective standard?
Possibly that would be one way you could change it. But again, it doesn't do anything to change our petition, because what our petition would do is it would be something that would be a factor in the reasonableness. And what we're suggesting is that reasonableness dictates the independent communication of its own isn't enough.
Put your whole petition into 757.19.
Correct. But again, we're looking at it as a factor, balancing the First Amendment and the due process concerns.
Mr. Wittenweiler, I started out thinking obviously you'd have exactly the same position as the Board of Realtors in regard to any further study of these matters. Now, as I listen to you, I hear you saying, oh, you know, there are some things that we should be studying. What should we be studying? What should we turn over to a commission to look at, if anything?
Well, the first thing I would like to clarify is I did not consult with my client on whether or not they have any views on the study committee.
I'm asking you.
And no, but I am telling you my personal view as a member of the bar, as a lawyer who has struggled with looking at, you know, the Judicial Code of Conduct and then the 757, I see that as something that needs to be studied. But it's not the issue of recusal based on campaign contributions that's in the realtor's petition that WMC is joining, or independent communication. To me, those issues don't need to be studied. Those are the ones, the easy decisions for the court, the easy parts of the Code of Conduct to adopt today, to add those to Chapter 60 to the Judicial Code of Conduct. You can bring those in there, and then you can work through the decisions of how you bring in the objective standard to the 757.
So you see that there is at least some issue as to how you balance the subjective standard that we find in the statute and the objective standard in the code?
Correct. My personal view is I have agreed with the dissent in the American TV case since I read it.
Counsel, I see on page 18 of your brief, you're talking about Caperton. And as a follow-up, the Caperton, you say, according to the court, determining whether recusal is warranted, quote, requires an objective inquiry into whether the contributor's influence on the election under all of the circumstances would offer a possible temptation to the average judge to lead him not to hold the balance nice, clear, and true, end of quote, Caperton at 2264. That's the test, isn't it?
It's the totality of the circumstances. I think
objective inquiry with the totality of circumstances. That's at least the test that was set forth in Caperton.
Correct. I think that's what Justice Kennedy is articulating more than anything else, because he is very clear. I know it's on page 13 of the slip opinion. He's very clear in that decision to say, you know, these are extreme circumstances, extraordinary facts. And he says, not every campaign contribution, when he says contribution, he's lumping in independent communications and regular contributions. He's lumping it all together. And he's saying, not every campaign contribution is going to rise to the level of recusal. It's going to be something more than that. And I think the more than that is where that objective test comes in and where that review of the totality of the circumstances comes in.
And this pronouncement from the United States Supreme Court is the floor. We have to give at least that, as the opinion goes on to state. States can do more if they want, but their pronouncement as to what's required, the United States Supreme Court, is the floor upon which we have to be either accepting in total or embroidery upon.
Well, I'm not sure I would accept it as a floor.
The ceiling? Where is it?
No. That's exactly what I was going to suggest. To me, it's more of a ceiling. There is a point in time that you will get to, that the situation will be so objectionable. We will find it, you know, it's like the pornography. I can't define it until I see it. I just know it. It's the same thing with this. It's the recusal jumped out to Justice Kennedy, who very well, you know, understands the First Amendment, understands campaign finance law, but just couldn't let this set of facts, this set of bad facts, sit any longer.
When I say floor and ceiling, I'm not communicating well. By that, I mean the opinion went on to say that states can give have to give at least this amount of right to a litigant, but in their recusal standards can give even more.
I think you look at Caperton calling into question the American TV case, because I think that's where, if you pick up on Justice Kennedy's language there, it draws into question the result that the court reached there and whether or not you do need this kind of objective outlet to be there in certain circumstances.
That's the same standard that we applied in Donahue just about a year and a half ago, correct? This American
TV. It is, yes, in a per curiam opinion, if I recall. So I'm not sure how everything worked out here on that decision, but yes, you did seem to embody somewhat American TV, but at the same time, I think it was probably because all of you looked at the totality of the circumstances as an objective body reviewing that case. There was discussion in there that Justice Butler had gone through the thought process, so he had done what he was required to do.
All we really did was review whether he did his job,
right,
which he's required to do under the statute.
But I also don't think, though, you could read Donahue as saying that the court as a whole, though, objected to, and I believe it was in Justice Prosser's concurring opinion in that case where he talks about this is an issue the court needs to take on because we're ignoring these issues that are floating around out there.
There was a due process element in Donahue, at least in the petition or the motion.
Okay.
That was cited in the case, but not necessarily discussed at length.
And Donahue, to me, when you read the facts of Donahue, shows all the involvement that goes on out there beyond just independent communications, beyond contributions. You have endorsements. You have volunteer activities. You have all these sorts of issues that are floating around out there where you have to ask yourself, what clarity are you going to provide to judges so that, you know, they have a better idea of what are the circumstances that give rise to the level that they need to be thinking about recusal. And what we're asking in our petition is merely, solely, only that independent communication out there on its own is not enough to rise to the level to warrant recusal.
So you would say to the judge to consider other things, such as the percent of the total expenditures, such as the nature of the case before the judge, such as?
I think surrounding scandal. I mean, you look at the totality of the circumstances in Caperton, the fact that, you know, that at one point on the multiple requests for recusal, I think it's when you got to that third request or second request for recusal, two of the justices of the three that were requested on the Supreme Court got off the case. This justice decided not to. I mean, something like that, I would imagine, weighed into Justice Kennedy when he's looking at the totality of the circumstances.
Without any explanation until after the petition for certiorari was accepted.
Correct.
Then the judge gave an explanation. Do you favor explanations of sitting or not sitting after a motion for
recusal? I haven't discussed that with the client. I don't know whether or not they have an opinion on that.
The realtors don't cover independent contributions. Yours deals only with that because that's what your client is involved in.
Well, they do make PAC independent expenditures and PAC contributions.
Okay.
But what we're addressing, I mean, again, if you look at kind of the sequence of events with the Legal Women Voters petition, the Realtors petition, the Caperton decision, it would have been difficult to sit on our hands at this hearing and not come forward with a clarification to the Code of Conduct that addressed this issue.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I understand that. I'm just trying to, but you join with the realtors, but you're covering different issues.
Correct. The realtors deals exclusively with the contributions and endorsements.
And you don't deal with lawyer contributions.
No, because if a lawyer was making an independent expenditure.
Right. Just trying to set what the boundaries are of these different petitions and what they're doing.
So your client, though, adopts the realtor's position in regard to the direct contributions.
They signed on to a letter with 12 organizations in support of it and vice versa.
Okay.
But the petition itself deals solely with the issue of independent communications.
Do you see any reason why the court shouldn't adopt your petition today?
I see no reason whatsoever at all for you to adopt a study commission with it to delay any longer. I think it would be an absolutely wonderful thing for all those judges that are going to be on the ballot in the spring to have the court adopt something today.
See any reason not to adopt the realtor's petition today?
No, I think they both work together well. And if you'll notice, we numbered ours to follow theirs with the hopes that you would do theirs first and ours second.
How does, sometimes we think we're the center of the universe. No, we're not.
We all have that problem.
Yeah. How does your proposal play out for the single judge in Langlade County when the litigant before him has formed a committee to do these independent expenditures? In support of him.
Right.
Lots of money. You're the litigant on the other side. How does that play out?
Well, under the league's petition?
No, under yours.
Under our petition?
Yeah.
In it of itself, it would not be a reason for recusal. It still gives the judge the ability, if they would want to, you know, a party can go before them and they can weigh the facts, you know, what else is going on in the community, whether or not there's another sort of relationship, whether or not the contributions maybe are indicia of some other sort of bias. Our point is that independent communications shouldn't equal partiality, shouldn't be bias with an equal sign. I think what it does is it may raise a further investigation or consideration of what are the totality of the circumstances, and maybe the judge needs to do some soul searching to figure out whether or not there's anything there. But if it just comes back to the contribution or the independent communication in itself, I think, and they still feel that in their mind, you know, you read what a judge should be looking at in their own mind, they feel that they can deal with this in an impartial manner, I think they should be able to allow it to proceed.
But you have to do an objective standard, too, under Caperton.
Under Caperton, if there's a due process concern, correct. There would need to be some sort of fallback.
Caperton covers independent expenditures.
Caperton suggests that an independent expenditure, an independent communication, would be a factor in the totality of the circumstances.
Sure.
Right. But I don't think Caperton at all is suggesting that it was the independent communications alone that would require that judge in the one county to recuse themselves.
But, for example, unlike your client, the independent expenditure in Caperton, and this is an important fact, that was an actual party. The contributor was an actual party before the court and spent $3 million to presumably try to get that justice elected.
Right.
They were a party to the litigation at the time they made the expenditure. Don't you think that's an important issue?
I would agree with you that I think that's a very important issue.
We have cases before this court where the parties before the court have contributed to justices' campaigns, yet justices on this court haven't felt any particular compunction to step down, even if it's during their campaign.
But I would imagine that is because they've looked at it and they understand that a contribution doesn't equal bias. And again, that's what we're suggesting.
To be fair and impartial, at least they used to be under the law, presumed to be fair and impartial until someone suggested otherwise. I think that still is the law, but this almost turns that on its head. And as Justice, I think, Gableman was suggesting, presumes a judge who legally accepts a campaign contribution to be something other than fair and impartial. That's never been the law.
Right, and that's where we disagree and why we ask the court to reject the league's petition as well as Justice Babich's petition is because under their petitions there is that equating that a contribution somehow over a certain dollar amount equals partiality. And what we're suggesting is hopefully we have elected people to the position of judges that a contribution in itself doesn't equal partiality or bias.
From my perspective, it'd be nice to have the same rules apply to everyone on the court. And so it would be nice to have a hard and fast rule. But that's not always, sometimes I think, as Justice Roberts said, the cure is worse than the disease. I mean, is there a way to do that? Is there a way to have the litigants before the court always know that their justices are fair and impartial? That is the best possible world for all of us to exist in. That's the best for a trial court, that's the best for anything. But to just bite off part of this and not deal with the other issues isn't fair either. I mean, do you think, for example, that someone before the court who's their opposition sent out a lot of emails to get a justice elected, that person's going to feel that they are getting a fair shake?
I don't think in and of itself you can assume that is going to lead to it. There's a law review article, a study that was done by a professor at Georgetown Law School, Roy Shotland, years ago, where he talks about the backfiring independent expenditures where they didn't get the candidate's support. They didn't, you know, in fact, they angered the individual or it resulted in a result other than the support. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Buckley decision talks about why it is we're going to allow independent communications to occur to an unlimited amount is because you don't know necessarily what the value is to that particular candidate. I happened at one point in my life worked for an individual who rejected independent spending on his behalf, and quite frankly, the people who did it were looked down on more than gained favor with the individual.
Well, with all due respect, that's what I did during my campaign. It didn't make a hill of beans difference, right?
Right.
But there's only so much a candidate can do, and you cannot collaborate with another group, and you shouldn't be able to. And that's how we stay above that. Judges also, at least until judges don't raise their own funds in campaigns, but large amounts of funds are raised in judicial races. Even you know, one side may have a lot, the other side may have a little, both sides might have the same amount, you never know. But campaign contributions, at least until recently, have never been in and of themselves a reason to suggest that a judge can't be fair and impartial.
And it's not in our brief, but it's in the submission that was given to the court by the Department of Justice, where they talk about, you know, the elements that we all look for in a judge, and, you know, experience, intellect, you know, participation in the bar, and impartiality. Does this person bring to the court that just inherent ability to look at things in that fair and impartial manner and without preconceived notions? And again, what we're suggesting is that the independent communication in itself doesn't lead to that bias, that hopefully that the justices have or a judge has those other qualities that's going to allow them to step back and still come at things with that impartial point of view.
Counsel, we've spent a lot of money talking about dollars and contributions of money, but one of the big components of a campaign, a successful campaign, is getting volunteers to work on your behalf and asking, seeking their support to pitch in and do things on their own time. Why wouldn't it be a natural extension of the League of Women Voters petition, say, if a particularly diligent volunteer donated thousands of dollars of their own time and was able to quantify that? Why wouldn't it be a logical extension of their petition to seek recusal because of that volunteer's efforts?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that, you know, if you go through the League's petition, you can pick it apart for a number of different reasons. That's one of them. I think the court has brought up today that it's lacking a media exemption. It's lacking a member communication exemption. You know, and it's missing all those elements that First Amendment jurisprudence has gotten campaign finance statutes to adjust themselves to still allow for the right of association, the right to free speech. Those elements aren't embodied in that rule petition.
I think it's helpful to provide the perspective on Caperton that I tried or that we started discussing before. And if we look at the bottom of page 2, we learn that in addition to contributing the $1,000 statutory maximum to Benjamin's campaign committee, Blankenship donated almost $2.5 million to a political organization formed under 26 U.S.C. Section 527, which opposed Benjamin's, or which favored Benjamin and opposed Benjamin's challenger. Blankenship's donations accounted for more than two-thirds of the total funds raised. This was not all. Blankenship spent, in addition, just over $500,000 on independent expenditures for direct mailings and letters soliciting donations, as well as television and newspaper advertisements to support Brent Benjamin. Last two sentences. To provide some perspective, Blankenship's $3 million in contributions were more than the total amount spent by all other Benjamin supporters and three times the amount spent by Benjamin's own committee. How does that compare with the $1,000 that we're looking at in the proposed petition?
And I would agree with you, Justice Gableman, you have to look at those totality of circumstances, and you can't just say that one element in itself is enough to warrant, you know, bias or say that there's bias. And unfortunately, both the Bablish petition and the League of Women Voters petition equate a contribution at a certain amount to bias. I mean,
so
and that's the end result of their petition.
Justice Kennedy says $3 million, which accounts for over two-thirds, really. Because they go on. It was over two-thirds what was spent. He doesn't do the math totally, but it was over two-thirds. And so what those petitions that you're describing seem to do is import in isolation a focus on a contribution,
right,
as opposed to two-thirds, over two-thirds funding of a particular candidate's campaign.
Correct. I would agree with that. But I also would suggest, you know, if you read a few pages ahead in the Caperton decision, Justice Kennedy goes on to talk about all the other issues, you know, the the scandalous facts that were floating around in the background. I honestly think that had a true effect on the court's decision because of the totality of circumstances. If you look in Justice Roberts' dissenting opinion, even though it's his dissenting opinion, he says in so many words, you know, this is a case where I look at it and I go, why the hell didn't he recuse himself? and it's, you know, but he doesn't join the majority opinion.
In that case, I mean, the facts are important. In that jurisdiction, there were people who could replace him on the court, unlike, for example, the Wisconsin Supreme Court. If someone steps off, you're off.
Correct. And to me, you know, and I hear what the league is saying, there is no right to choose your judge. And no one is going to quarrel with that. But if you think of the effect of a membership organization, whether it's a labor organization, a trade association, whatever the group may be constituted as, they are in the business of endorsing candidates, making independent communications, making contributions, and, you know, we just go down the line. Eventually, you don't have seven justices anymore because, you know, four have to sit off because of how election cycles come up. You know, and if you're doing it at the local level, how far away do you have to go to find the judge that the local association didn't endorse? It's not a question of the right, you know, of somehow professing to have a right to choose your judge. It's having the access to the judicial system. Because what the end effect of their suggested rule is it takes away that right to even be able to participate in front of the court.
Right. And you're talking about knocking off particular justices with contributions, effectively, by forcing their recusal. Doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of the question of, if that's adopted, who decides? Do the four members of this court decide if three have to get off a particular case? That doesn't even begin to touch that question.
Now, the administrative functionality of what happens next is one that, you know, raises all kinds of questions and is problematic. The other, you know, point that I take issue with is this idea that waiver solves everything. In my opinion, waiver gets you back to where you started. Waiver gets back to the judge making the decision themselves over whether or not subjectively they should or shouldn't be on the case.
I think on an appellate level, waiver also has a tremendous problem because the decisions we make don't affect just the parties before us or we would never take the case.
Right.
And so therefore, if the parties waived, well, maybe six other people who were interested in this issue would not approve that waiver. And I think they have every right, even though they're not parties, to a fair and impartial decision from the court. So I personally have a lot of problems with waiver on an appellate court. On a trial court where the decision binds the parties, I think it may have some validity. But at an appellate level, I don't see how it can function and then still say this court sets the rule of law on an issue for the whole state.
And even at the trial court level, though, you then have to get into some sort of examination of intent of the donor or the independent spender that again, I wrestle with how do you deal with that administratively?
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Wittenweiler, the test is not merely actual bias, but appearance?
Correct.
We agree on that. Your real test here placed affirmatively or negatively is not solely based, really is a totality of the circumstances test.
Yes.
You'd have no objection then to add a sentence that said that recusal based on that contributions are part of the totality of the circumstances upon which a judge would recuse himself or herself.
I don't think you could object to that because of Caperton. I don't think you could object to that outright.
Can't, because it is at a minimum Caperton. And therefore you would not object to any commentary that would give criteria or give some of the circumstances that might go into the case, such as the percent of the total contributions or the percent of the total expenditures.
And again, I think the difficulty comes down to how, you know, you write that out. But right, in concept, I think you'd be silly not to accept that as a factor in the totality of circumstances.
Right. The other aspect of this is due process as set forth in Caperton under the fact situations talk about extreme circumstances. If you read
other cases of the United States Supreme Court, of the Court of Appeals, and of state courts, a due process is not limited to extreme circumstances, the concept. Do you agree with that?
I would disagree with you in the context of First Amendment and, you know, campaign finance, independent communication. I think that I'm not aware of anyone who has suggested that there is a lower standard that could be applied that somehow due process is going to trump your First Amendment rights.
Well, what about Justice Kennedy, both in his concurrence in White and his opinion here indicates that you can have recusal, that there's not this high extreme circumstances.
Correct, but in the totality of circumstances of a due process concern. But again, I don't think he somehow is placing due process above the First Amendment.
Okay. I know that concerns you and concerns me, but the concept is that these recusal standards on reasonableness and totality of the circumstances as set forth in the code of Section 455, which I think you're familiar mm-hmm. with, are you not?
Correct.
And in various state codes are standards that might not be extreme circumstances. Case law seems to say not, that they fit Justice Kennedy's description.
Well, you know, it's going to come down to, I mean, extreme is something that's going to be a community standard. To me, I would still think it would be the extreme, extraordinary circumstances. Mm-hmm. And the question is, you know, what happens in Vilas County as extreme, the same thing that happens in West Virginia? I mean, there may be different levels of extremeness based on where you are. So
Nevada has a $50,000.
Well, and corporations can give directly in Nevada.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have to remember, in 26 states, corporations give directly to candidates. And so what extreme is going to be in those states is going to be a lot different than a state like Wisconsin.
And that's a pending issue in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, not on contributions, on independent expenditures, correct.
Okay.
Excuse me?
They lop over?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor, because I think that if you look at the Citizens United case that's, you know, currently being deliberated by the U.S. Supreme Court, the issue of contributions is not before them at all. It is all about independent communications and looking at the sources of funding for those communications. I would be shocked to see them go into contributions, especially given that just however many years ago now, 4 years ago in the Beaumont, I can't remember which one now, where they rejected the idea of qualified nonprofit corporations being allowed to contribute directly. There's a lot of cases under Massachusetts Citizens for Life where certain nonprofits can make independent expenditures because they get all their money from individuals. And the U.S. Supreme Court, I think it was 4 years ago, rejected the idea that they could make contributions. So for them to now do that in Citizens United, I think would be a stretch.
That's what we're talking about, independent expenditures in support of a candidate. But it strikes me that maybe if we don't adopt your proposal, so assume that, should we then consider whether candidates should get off of cases where someone engaged in an independent expenditure against them to get the other person elected? What about the contributors to the other campaign or organizations that supported the other? Should justices then recuse because those people actively worked against that justice?
All of your questions are, you know, I think the sorts of things that judges would be forced to deal with without the adoption of this, because they are, you know, I don't want to say it's going to happen fast and furious, but I do think you'll see people raise those exact issues in recusal motions, you know, and suggest, and you've already experienced that. I mean, that was the Donahue case, is bringing up the very issues that you're talking about. And I think there are, you know, eight different ways you could slice it, and looking at contributions against, contributions for, independent spending against. What happens when you didn't do anything about the person who won, but you did it to the person who lost? I mean, we could draw a grid and probably come up with 64 different variations and have to follow through our decision tree of how we get to the point of what the judge is going to do. And that's why our petition, I think, cuts through all that and just says, look, on the independent communication on its own, solely the independent communication in itself is not a reason for recusal. You're going to have to bring to the court something more than that. And that's what that's consistent with Caperton. It's consistent with what Justice Kennedy wrote in that decision. And I guess that's why we would urge you to adopt our petition today and not delay it any longer.
Thank you, counsel. We will now reach retired Justice William Babbage in his petition 09-11.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, everybody.
Morning. It's good seeing you, even if it's on the other side of the bench.
Thank you. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to appear in front of you and to see all of you. I've missed you, believe it or not.
You too, maybe.
I miss the intellectual give and take and the academic atmosphere, and it certainly was the most enjoyable 20 years of my life serving with you. And before I begin, I do want to say that I know six of you quite well, and I hope to get to meet Justice Gableman sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. We've met.
We've met. You swore me in this room 15 years
ago. Is that right?
Yes. You must
have been your number. I was a mere child at the time.
Imagine how young I was.
But I do want to say about all of you that I have the utmost faith in your independence and in your integrity, and that this is a measure designed for the future and not for any member of this court. I'm proud of this court, and I'm proud of serving with you, and I'm proud of each and every member. Back in 1975, I think it was Chief Justice Bruce Bialfus, talking about court reform, said that court reform is not for the short of breath or short-winded, but it is a long, long road to an answer. Well, back in 1975 also, Jim Clauser and I, who are good friends and are good friends today, believe it or not, we pushed through the legislature a public financing bill that limited the amount that could be spent, not in judicial elections, but in legislative elections. Well, Buckley versus Vallejo quickly threw that out. But that was almost 35 years ago, and I have been involved in campaign finance reform since then. And it's not for the short of breath or the easily winded, I can tell you that. Back in 1975, I spent $12,000 to get elected to the state senate. Today, those races run over $1 million. Back in 1983, I spent $200,000 to get elected to this court. And we all know what's happened to those expenditures. This problem is getting worse, not better. And it will continue to get worse. And the basic problem is the public's confidence in the independence and integrity of the judiciary. At least as far as this court, it's one of perception, but it could quickly become one of reality. The figures that I have seen, the most recent figures, shows that from 1996 to 2000, approximately $75 million was spent on judicial campaigns. From 2000 to 2006, the same amount of period, that increased almost 70% to $125 million, and I'm sure it's far more than that now. And we can see just what's happened in the state of Wisconsin. The cost of campaigns have grown like topsy. And I can tell you this, because once I left the court, I was no longer sheltered from criticism. For 20 years, I'd never been told I wrote a bad opinion.
At least not openly.
I hate to know what they were saying behind closed doors. But what the bar is saying and what the people on the street are saying is that their trust and confidence in the integrity of the Supreme Court and other courts in the state is in great jeopardy. Something must be done, and it must be done quickly. Because if you don't do it now, every year that passes will make it more and more difficult to accomplish real reform, just as it did with the legislature. Now, I applaud this court for adopting unanimously, I understand, a public financing request of the legislature, and I support that. But the problem with the public financing is it does not solve the problem that's immediately before us. The big problem that's immediately before us is the amount of campaign contributions from third parties, either to the judicial candidate himself or herself, or to independent expenditures outside the judicial campaign committee. Public financing will not help that. Let me tell you what the problem with public financing is, and I hope they can be solved. Number one, there's no guarantee public financing is going to pass the legislature. They have no money. They have no money whatsoever. And to ask them to support it is going to be very, very difficult. Number two, if they do support it, the amounts that they will come up with for public financing will probably be woefully inefficient. $200,000 is a lot of money to them. Well, that's a pittance compared to $1 million of outside expenditures. And thirdly, public financing does nothing to close the loophole of scurrying independent committees or special interests to the protection of the anonymity of the so-called 527 groups. And that's a basic, basic problem. Because once they are hidden by 527s, to get at them, to find out who the source of those fundings are, is, under the present system, near impossible. I mean, it makes a big difference. If a campaign committee is campaigning on behalf of public education and you don't know who is supporting those campaign ads, it makes a big difference if it's an independent educational group or if it's WEAC. But the public doesn't know that. So that's the problem with public financing. They can be resolved, but meanwhile, my proposal is a very necessary addition to it and one that can be enacted immediately by this court and put it into effect for future elections.
Why did you pick 757.19 instead of the code? You're the only one.
Because I felt that 757 allowed for a review in front of a neutral party, and we've seen that the judicial commission is perfectly capable of reviewing the actions of individual judges. That was the primary reason. The second.
So you think this review would be before the judicial commission under 757? What about a motion to the court?
I think it would be, but let me say this as a prefatory remark. I deliberately gave you a bare-bones proposal. I didn't confuse it up with a lot of specifics, because I think those specifics are best left to the judgment of the court. I gave you a bare-bones proposal so that you could concentrate on the concept, and the concept being recusal in the face of certain contributions. And that, for instance, brings me to the question of the dollar amount in my proposal. I set $10,000, but that's an arbitrary figure. It seems to me that what this court can and should do is define what is the amount that's too much. What amount allows for free and vigorous participation by outside third parties, and at the same time does not produce the reality or the perception of buying a judge or buying the judge's vote. I thought $10,000 was a pretty good figure, but it could be more, it could be less. It should not be artificially low, because that could discourage speech. It should not be artificially high, because then it does nothing. So let me address what my proposal is, and then I will address for a moment the realtors and Wisconsin manufacturers' proposals. My proposal contains really three parts. The first part is subsection G, and that section calls for automatic recusal from a case when the judge's campaign committee has received donations of $10,000 from a party or a party's lawyer, or when the judge's campaign committee has received contributions of $10,000 or more from a person or entity having a direct or indirect interest in the outcome of the case. Again, $10,000 is purely arbitrary, something that you can decide what's best. But obviously, there is a figure that's the correct figure. Caperton set the outermost limits. is it Caperton?
Bill, could I ask you a question about
sure,
that?
Sure, please do. Be as tough on me as you've been on other parties, Jessica.
you have been affiliated with Michael Best.
Yes.
Now, let's say I would understand what you're proposing here. If you gave me $10,000, But what about all the attorneys in the firm of Michael Dustin Friedrich, just as an example?
If all the attorneys in Michael Best put together a war chest of $200,000 or something for you?
Well, $10,000.
Of $10,000. My proposal would provide that if you are a party or a party's lawyer, it would be automatic recusal.
So $10,000 from Michael Best would say, I'm out of the case.
That's right, if it's from the party or a party's lawyer. Now, traditionally, Michael Best would not be considered a party or a party's lawyer. But if they have a direct or indirect influence in the outcome of the case, then you're out of the case, but not just because they gave you that kind of money.
Why wouldn't it be a lawyer? The name is on the brief, Michael Best by John Smith, representing ABC Company.
Well, my thought there is that the purpose of the recusal is to provide a litigant, an adverse litigant, with a level playing field.
Right.
And I don't think that has a whole lot to do with the level playing field, which lawyer has contributed a whole lot. You certainly don't want to discourage an excellent law firm like Michael Best and Friedrich from participating, or Habish and Habish. But on the other hand, I don't think they have the direct or indirect influence other than representative in the adversary process.
Justice Savage?
Yes.
What different people have said today caused me to think of all these different ways of looking at the same or similar issues. And so what you've just said, when you said you want to avoid the perception or reality of someone thinking that a judge's vote has been bought, right?
Right.
Have you thought about the idea then that maybe instead of a dollar figure, it would be more appropriate to place a percentage on a contribution? For example, if the justice or judge contributes a certain amount to their campaign, they're less dependent on other people for contributions, right?
Right.
If they contribute very little to their campaign, they're almost entirely dependent on other people's money.
Right.
Maybe a valid way of looking at this might be a percentage of what the justice has contributed. And so the more dependent you are on someone else's money, the easier it would be, or the standard would be easier to require recusal. That is?
It could well be, Justice Ziegler. To be frank, I did not.
I just started thinking about that because I'm thinking, it is different depending on
different. But you raised a lot of good questions about volunteers that I had not addressed at all, and there have been questions. No questions raised, but as I put this together, I did not include a directive to the judge to participate in helping to determine who the contributors are. I recall Justice Wilcox a couple of years ago saying if he had known who the contributors to his campaign, a certain aspect of his campaign were, he would not have sat. So those are all things, that's the flesh on the bones, and that's what I want you to do, or the study committee. I just wanted to concentrate on the concept. And the concept is recusal, and at a point where, let's put it another way, where a litigant on the other end of that feels he can't get a fair shake.
Right.
It's a common sense standard. And Justice Bradley pointed it out very well. If I go into court and a party or a party's or special interest has contributed $200,000 to a judge's campaign, I would not feel good about it. I'd not feel that I could get a fair shake. And let me tell you this, if you avoid this question today and adopt the WMC or the realtor's proposal, you haven't done away with it. You haven't begun to do away with it, because as these contributions continue to increase, there will be more and more challenges by parties who feel aggrieved that the right to due process of law has been violated.
Justice Babich, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute. You asked us to act on your proposal today, and yet it's clear that you've listened to all the questions that have been asked by members of the court. I want to know whether or not you oppose the idea of the Bar Association, the State Bar, that we establish a study committee and have a study committee look at all of these various proposals and perhaps other proposals, such as the percentage proposal we just heard by Justice Ziegler. What is your position on that?
Well, let me say that I think the seven most sophisticated people and able to put flesh on the bones of the skeleton is the seven people that are sitting in front of me. They know, you know, you've all been through campaigns, and you know some of the problems that we're talking about. But I would not oppose that study. In fact, I would support it. In fact, I wish I could sit on it, because assuming my health allows, that's probably the most important, to put the flesh on the bones. But it's got to be quickly done. It can't be one of these committees that sits for a year and then some kind of report comes out, because I remember as majority leader, whenever I had a really tough problem, I'd bury it in a committee.
and get a study. That's not the idea, I'm sure, of the State Bar.
The idea. And the court would not be remiss in doing it. One of the worst things that the court could do would be to adopt the WMC proposal and the realtor's proposal today. That needs a lot more thought. My sense of those two proposals is this. They could have saved a lot of paper. They could have simply said, we support the status quo and we want it memorialized into law, period, respectfully submitted, because that's what they want. They want a system that has been in existence for years, that has worked for them but has not worked for the average litigant, and they want it memorialized into law. I think that would be the worst thing that this court could do.
Why do you say it hasn't worked for the average litigant, Justice Pavlich? Do you feel that litigants have been treated unfairly as a result of campaign contributions?
No, I don't, Justice Gableman, at least in this court. But clearly, the Caperton case is the outer limits of how unfair it is to allow money to have that kind of influence in a judicial campaign. And I think the way contributions are going in Wisconsin and the public perception that's out there is quickly reaching the point, if it hasn't already reached the point, where the public's confidence in the integrity and the independence of the judiciary is in question. And you are holders of seats of long and proud tradition of independence in the judiciary without fear or favor. And your job is to deliver justice. And if somebody has contributed $500,000 or expenditures have made to $500,000 in a campaign against you, for sitting justice, I submit to you that common sense dictates that the parties that are affected by that will not feel they're getting a fair share.
Sure, and now you've just taken it a lot closer to the Caperton scenario with your $500,000 hypothetical
right.
contribution. But it does seem to sort of beg the question about $10,000 or $1,000. And I also see a lot of what's not being talked about here today is the fact that a lot of people give money in judicial elections to the candidate that they think will be fair, not for some improper, weird motive, and that they're going to buy a seat for $1,000 or $10,000 or even $1 million. That I think that at least needs to go mentioned.
Well, they expect something in return when you contribute $500,000.
But you know, Counselor, when we had the Donahue case, the
right.
challenge was made to Justice Butler's participation in that case because lawyers who were on the Donahue case had given him, I don't remember the exact amount, but my recollection, it was less than $2,000.
Right.
And the other side hadn't given him anything. And the allegation was made is that Justice Butler was biased, and that was a very small amount. So I think, you know, if it's your ox that gets gored by an opinion, that person never thinks. No matter what dollar amount, I mean, if you have $500, you
have $200.
That's
why I always give the litigant,
right.
the losing litigant, his facts.
Yeah, right. That's right, because, I mean, they always feel that they got gypped somehow and
that's
the other
right.
guy got a leg up. So it's really hard to get your arms around this.
It's tough to draw that line, and that's just one of the lines that's tough to draw. And you have brought up your concerns about free speech.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about that.
And let me address that for a moment. First of all, I am not convinced that there is a free speech issue in this issue. And that is because there is nothing in my proposal or the league's proposal that limit that limits the amount of speech that any of these groups want to give. They can speak all they want. They can speak for $1 million worth, and there's nothing that limits it. What the effect of that giving that money is to recuse a judge. Well, whether that bears on free speech or not, I think is problematic. But secondly, free speech is not an absolute right. And in the right of the litigant to a fair trial, to a justice that is not only actually free of prejudice, but appears to be free of prejudice, the right of the citizens to an independent judiciary, which is a fiercely held right, particularly in Wisconsin. I mean, Justice Abramson and Justice Bradley have been fighting this from the day they took office, is put alongside the interests of free speech. It seems to me that the right, an independent judiciary has a great deal of weight on that scale against free speech, if there is a free speech issue. And, excuse the shaking, I always get my martini stirred, not shaken.
You and James Bond, right?
Yes, yes. So I really think that this free speech issue could be a red herring. It might not be. I don't pretend to be an expert on free speech, but I do know that it is not an absolute right and must be weighed against the rights. And these are very, very important rights, the rights of a litigant to a fair and impartial judiciary and the rights of the citizens to a fair and independent judiciary. If we continue on as we are going on, we are going to become judged as politicians and not as judges. And that's the worst thing that can happen to this court, the very worst thing. Let me go on, and I don't intend to take a lot of your time, continuing the explanation of the bill. Section H refers to contributions made outside the judge's campaign committee by a third party or entity, and it calls for automatic recusal when the expenditures are in excess of $10,000 or whatever figure you want. Now, the real nut of my proposal comes in the next section labeled challenges. This is my effort, and I worked on this for literally hundreds of hours, talked to the Brennan Center in person a number of times. And that is, how do you, when you put in these kinds of restrictions, how do you prevent an outside special interest from scurrying into the so-called 527s and getting the anonymity that the 527s provide? Almost impossible to resolve at first, and I almost gave up on it about 6 months ago, but I kept banging away at it, and I finally came up with this proposal. And that is that if there are expenditures in excess of whatever dollar amount you choose, and they are challenged by the other party, by one of the parties, then the challenge contribution, the contributors to that fund, must reveal the source of their funds. I don't believe that's a free speech issue, the speech of being able to hide behind anonymity. We're not telling them that they can't speak, we're just telling them we need to know what the source of your funds are. If they refuse to reveal what the source of those funds are, then it's automatic recusal.
But, Counselor, isn't that kind of contrary to the main premise that your rule is that if someone gives a judge more than $10,000, because you would then identify with that person, say, aha, that judge gave this, that judge received more than $10,000 from this person, it's the connection. But if you have these independent groups, I think Attorney Wittenauer said there was a proposal, which I'd never heard about, but I thought was intriguing, that everybody gives all their money to a black box, and nobody knows who supported them or who paid for their running of the campaign or who paid for independent expenditures. Doesn't that proposal you put together cut against the nexus that you seem to say is necessary otherwise?
Well, Justice Rogensack, I have never bought the proposition that judges don't know where their money comes from. I think we all know where our money comes from. We try not to let it influence us. We try not to find out where it comes from, but eventually we all know. It's just a fact of life. Now, some people in this court may disagree, but I'd be willing to bet that there's not one person on this court that doesn't know where their contributions came from.
Well, they're on file.
What's that?
They're on file.
Sure. But I mean,
he's
the
talking
real
about independent
funds,
expenditure.
Because the 527s adopt these high blowing titles for their name, you know, okay. Citizens for Complete Justice and things like that, and you can't find out who is supporting them. We had a case involving WMC a few years back where that was one of the issues that was raised, which is it's very important for the public to know the source of the funds. Not stop them from making campaign statements, not stopping them from engaging in vigorous debate, but giving the public the source of the funds, because sometimes it does make a difference if it's an independent group that has campaigned or it's WEAC.
Well, I think as I look at the transparency of concerns about not knowing who's under these independent expenditures, that's a different issue. That's, you know, when you read someone's ad or their pronouncement, how much credence do you give them? And that depends upon who's saying it, so what their interest is that's underlying the expenditure. But it's a different policy than saying there's a nexus between a contribution to a judge and the decision of that judge on that contributor's case. And so I just think it's a different nexus. You're asking for disclosure in order to have more knowledge. So what you're going to do is create more reasons for recusal because you get the nexus. But you don't have the nexus with the independent expenditures.
If there is disclosure by this third group, and it turns out that they have nothing to do, they don't have a direct or indirect interest in the outcome of the case, that ends it. There's not automatic recusal.
Right. I understand your proposal. I guess what I'm saying is I think disclosure of who's under the ads is I don't you know, that's not the same issue. That issue is transparency in elections and who's participating. But the issue we're looking at is, does a known participant gift to a judge's committee create a nexus that causes the appearance of bias so the judge has to recuse himself? To me, it's a very different policy. Not that one's better than the other, but I think they're very different.
Well, I think you're correct. And I understand the problem that you're pointing to, because any kind of figure creates a presumption.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so maybe the correct figure is 25,000. What shocks the conscience? What gives a litigant the feeling, the reasonable feeling, that they can't get a fair shake?
Yeah.
That the playing field is not level, and that's where you should set the figure. I don't presume to say that my $10,000 is wet in cement.
No, but you were clear about that.
Right, but I think that this court should set a figure. The cumulative wisdom of the seven of you is far better than the wisdom of me, and you can set a figure that I think would respond to the people's concern about an independent judiciary. That, believe me, I can't overstate how concerned I am and how concerned many, many people of this state are about the future of the independence of the judiciary. And this gives you an opportunity to hold off, to immediately enact something after study committee that will serve as a stopgap measure and, in fact, a very positive addition to public financing if it ever gets enacted. But you don't need the legislature to enact this. You can do it yourselves.
I'm not sure I understood your response to Justice Prosser. The ABC company is a party here to a case. Mm-hmm. Michael Best, by particular lawyers, represents the ABC company. Those lawyers who are on the brief contribute nothing, but the rest of the firm contributes in total $12,000. Mm-hmm. You know, and if it's so, I don't remember how many lawyers in Michael Best.
I don't know, 250.
Okay, I'm gonna
make it 200 for easy math, okay? So for easy math, they averaged out at $60 a contribution, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can the justice sit, or must the justice recuse himself or herself under age?
I think the justice can sit under my
okay.
proposal.
Okay, explain that then. What does it mean, cumulative 10,000 from a party or relative of a party or a party's lawyer? That's what's bugging me.
Mm-hmm.
Party's lawyer.
Is this under challenges under G?
H. I've got you creating 757.19.
I think the essence of the question is, do you mean under a party's lawyer, just the particular lawyers who are representing the client, or do you mean the law, total law firm?
I would not mean the total law firm.
Okay. That's, I understand that. Okay. So you're not attributing?
No.
No. The two lawyers who signed the brief?
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
And of course, this is subject to the proposal by a committee. This would be part of the flesh that gets put on the bones of my basic concept here. But the basic concept, which I'm very proud because I worked long and hard on it, is I think one of the first in the country to address this problem of campaign expenditures outside the committee and how you reach them. It's a very difficult nut to crack. Brennan Center did not. I was interrupted rudely a few times during the course of putting this together, but the devil kept popping up. But
may I add a follow-up question? Let's just take a hypothetical here and understand, Justice, that this is of interest to me because I am the next person up for election.
I understand.
All right.
I intend to support you.
Well, you are a great American.
No further questions.
My question, Justice, let us say American Family Insurance. Everybody knows American Family. Suppose I were to get very lucky and of the total people who work at American Family, there were $15,000 in contributions, some from attorneys, some from executives, $15,000. May I sit in that case?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Well, maybe I don't understand the question.
Well,
you're saying that they banded together.
The American family
and made...
has made 15,000.
Made an entity contribution. Made a contribution of from the group that they formed. Well, then you can't say.
Well, individuals or the PAC is going to be limited. If there was a PAC contribution, that would be limited.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say the money coming out of people who are employees of American Family Insurance contribute $15,000. Am I precluded from sitting in that case?
That's a tough question. I'm having a difficult time getting my arms around it. I think if these are, this is a party, all State Farm is a party, and the contributions come from State Farm employees, I think that's got all the appearances of a third party contribution.
So can he sit?
I don't think so.
Okay, now the real question is this. If I know what the rules are, I might not agree with the rules, but if I know what the rules are going forward, that's one thing. But are you going to have a different rule for me than for people who were elected in the last 10 years, 9, 8 years?
Well, I thought about that question. It seems to me, in the ever-wise pronouncements of President Obama, we should look forward, not backwards. I don't think we can resolve the problems that have arisen in the past. we can resolve the problems that are going to arise in the future. So I would sunburst it. That would be my recommendation.
So that if I receive $15,000 from American Family, it would be considered necessary, absolutely necessary for me to withdraw. But
American Family was a party?
It was a party.
Yes.
But if, say, Justice Bradley were sitting in the case, she would not have to withdraw if she had received $15,000.
Right. Now, that's something that's up to the wisdom of this court again. Do you want to sunburst it, or do you want to try to cover past elections? I think it would be very difficult to cover past elections, particularly because I don't think the problem is of such monumental proportions in the state that we need to deal with the past. But we certainly do need to deal with the future.
But even as to the future, suppose he has to recuse himself from American Family cases for how long? 1 year after
the
election?
That's, again, some flesh on the bones.
Yep.
The devil, as you have frequently said, Chief, is in the details.
Right.
What about the
how wise I was.
What about justices who keep their campaign accounts open? Are they held to a different standard and they continue to fundraise than justices who just take the loss?
Hmm. Haven't thought about that either. The proposal does say cumulatively.
What if someone after the fact gives you a contribution? You just decided their case, then they send you the contribution.
Discretion,
I think this is fascinating. It raises more questions.
Oh, it does. Every you open up one door and five more are behind it. A contribution made after the election, but before the case has been heard, after the case has been heard.
Either.
If it comes in after the case has been heard, I think that whoever sits on that case would have some problems with the Judicial Commission. At least they would want to investigate what the circumstances of that contribution are if you put this in the hands of the Judicial Commission. Because if it can be shown that it was sort of a quid pro quo, then I think there's a real due process problem.
But if they give $9,999, we don't
yeah.
have to worry about it, right?
That's right. There's got to be a line drawn somewhere. And maybe your suggestion of a percentage is a good one, giving an absolute or a dollar limit or a percentage, whichever is greater, something like that.
Raises a problem if you don't have an opponent. Start raising campaign funds. Comes January, whatever the date is, there is no opponent. Mm-hmm. There is a large amount of money.
Well, my proposal says that this does not apply if you give the money back.
So you'd say give the money back.
Give the money back, or at least get it under $10,000. Get it under $10,000. Justice Prosser, you look like you have a question.
She's going to have a lot of them.
I have questions. It's also lunchtime.
Any other questions?
I would say, Justice Babich, that I think the court is very appreciative of the thought and effort that you have put into this, and it is wonderful to see you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I notice that my good friend Brady Williamson appears last. I normally would ask for 5 minutes of rebuttal, but I don't.
Do you have any summation? Any?
No, that's it. Nothing that hasn't been said. You know what's there. I think this is a golden opportunity to make huge advances for this court, and one that you will always be proud of in the future for having accomplished. And I certainly wish you best in your deliberations. And I do miss not being here. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Justice Babich should. Prosser said the sentiments of the court. We appreciate your thoughts on it, not only as a former member of this court, but as a former member of the state legislatures who dealt with this problem and similar problems for many years. So thank you.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to serve the state and serve this court.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
And Mrs. Babich.
Thank you.
We'll break for lunch. We'll come back at 1:30. We have 7 people signed up to speak. If there are any other people who wish to speak, they should sign up with the marshal, and so that we can get to some discussion. We're going to limit it to 10 minutes per person. Okay? Thank you. We'll see you back at 1:30.